are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. For Tony Reed, this case began as a claim of innocence in the murder of Donna Jo Richmond in 1975. While the errors in the original investigation and a flawed trial resulted in a guilty verdict, the reassessment confirmed that the defendant was framed, but the question became, by whom? Working with a new team of investigators, which included two of the original detectives, the probe uncovered a startling new possibility. Was the real culprit a serial offender? Turning to the public for information, Mr. Reed created the 12-26-75 podcast. Based on primary evidence and new interviews surrounding the murder of Donna Jo on that date in Exeter, California, the team re-examined every possibility. The investigators soon found something more than a terribly failed verdict. They discovered connections to the unsolved murders of Jennifer Armour and Claude Snelling and links to the East Area rapist. They uncovered shocking corruption by the original lead investigator, who illegally destroyed trial evidence and looked into the unexplained death of the original defense attorney. This pursuit led them right back to Exeter, where a new suspect in these murders emerged, Joseph D'Angelo, who was then a full-time sergeant with the local police department, the officer in charge of violent crimes and burglary investigations. This book is more than an adaptation of the 12-26-75 podcast. It shares new insight formed during the investigation and provides a firsthand look at the Tulare crimes, as well as exposing the faulty evidence used to obtain and maintain the false conviction. More than anything else, 12-26-75 demonstrates the enormous consequences of letting a serial killer go free, made worse when combined with the painful mistakes, infighting, and finger-pointing by certain jurisdictions. The catastrophic results are undeniable. Now that the mystery of how it unfolded is revealed, we can also begin to examine the reforms necessary to prevent this tragedy from happening again. The book that we're featuring this evening is 12-26-75 with my special guest, attorney, private investigator, and author, Tony Reed. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Tony Reed.
Thank you so much for having me, Dan. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you so much. Just when I thought I knew so much about this story, I had no idea. So thank you so much for this incredible investigation. And right away, tell us who this book is dedicated to and why.
Well, the book is dedicated to retired Sergeant John Vaughn, who worked with the Visalia Police Department for a number of years. In his capacity, he was sergeant and was the lead investigator on the homicide of Claude Snelling, who was killed in Visalia on September 11, 1975. And John really then led the investigation for several months afterwards, pursuing the suspect, and then followed the tracks of the offender, who was then unknown, up to Sacramento, was repudiated there, turned away, and the connections were denied, and really kind of just held a lot of the problems of the investigation in his own heart. Good idea to get involved again. But quickly, when he saw what the evidence was and why I was asking, he more than willingly opened up his heart and his mind back to get into the case again, and it truly helped sort out so many of the immense mysteries that were present, how things got flubbed and what happened. And so really, without John's assistance, that the case would have not been possible. No part of this investigation would have been there. He really helped solve so many of those critical mysteries.
Tell our audience who Margie Smith is and her role in all of this.
Margie is a Visalia resident. She lived in the city at the time of where the ransackings were going on. And quite interestingly, too, it just so happens that on the day that we're talking about, the principal date of the book, December 26, 1975, that she was working at the office of the realtor, whose name is Bill Rose. And Margie was working there as secretary. and had seen Oscar Clifton the day that he came in, and had known him through those connections, and just never seemed to fit right that this person with whom she had very brief contact stories that, you know, she really helped set a lot of the mysteries in action.
You think of a couple other people and important people in the East Area Rapist original Night Stalker case, Richard Shelby and Larry Crompton and Larry Poole. Tell us the role of all these law enforcement professionals.
Well, in the terms of Richard Shelby and Larry Crompton, both of those individuals have written books that were extremely helpful. But particularly, Richard Shelby is an individual who also opened up his mind to the questions. And he was sitting on the other side of the fence for the East Area Rapist series. He was one of the individuals who started working the cases as soon as the East Area Rapist emerged in Sacramento. He was the lead investigator there. And at the time when the connection was first presented as a possibility between Visalia and Sacramento, he was working the case. And so he really also understood what was going on at the Sacramento investigators. So really quite understanding what happened with the breakdown between why this suspect lead was very valuable suspect lead was not properly investigated, how they got derailed. Richard was the person who really answered that question. And in one word, it comes down to hypnosis. And that's something that I get into quite extensively in the book, because I don't believe people really understood exactly how it was used, how it was treated as evidence in this period of kind of became popularized, but how also it can be either extremely beneficial to a case or it can be very detrimental. However, regardless of however you look at it, after 1981, it was absolutely forbidden in the courtrooms of California, and it never should have, after that, had the impact on the case that it did. And so the other individual that you mentioned, Larry Poole, by the time I was contacting him, Larry had left law enforcement. He was out in the private sector and sent several messages engaging him about the case, pointing out some of the evidence that we had developed for the Exeter suspect and bouncing off the ideas about the timeline, the evidence, the connections, and saying, you know, too, Larry was one of the few individuals who really believed the viability of the Visalia connection. And so it was very important to have his perspective on the case and for him to assist early on in attempting to have some referrals go to the then current investigators, those who were still involved, and then unfortunately having that derailed as well. That's very painful.
You say there's several contributors who were some of the greatest, who deserve some of the greatest acknowledgement,
yes,
but can't be personally identified, including direct witnesses, victims, and law enforcement officers and their surviving family members. But you also acknowledge a few reporters. And so you talk about Lou Griswold, but also Lilia Luciano and Mike Bunnell of ABC 10. Tell us about their role in this.
Lou is a person that I met in Visalia. I had gone up quite early on after I'd done some of my initial investigations. In fact, after I had met with the current team at Visalia Police Department, and word was getting around the community about some of the investigation. And one of the leaders of the local Rotary asked me to come to a presentation, and Margie and I actually did this together and kind of gave a quick overview of the case and talked about some of the important connections, what we were looking at, the idea of the suspect being in Exeter. And after that presentation at the Rotary, Lou Griswold approached me and then, you know, he kind of said, hey, this sounds quite interesting. And Lou was still then a reporter with the Fresno Bee. So he was friends with Sergeant Vaughn and remembered the investigation and kind of got interested, reinvigorated in the story and helped write some of the early interviews, but also wrote a really important interview post-arrest, which thanked John Vaughn for his contributions to the original investigation. And he titled that article Sweet Vindication for the simple reason that John never really got the credit that he fully deserved for having put together the investigation correctly in the first place. And then the other two that you mentioned, Lilia and Mike, I worked with those two reporters for the better part of a year, gave them full access to the case, gave them, you know, a lot of my list of witnesses, showed them every page of the police reports, of the transcripts, anything they wanted to see, they got access to. Any questions that they had, they got access to. So it was really, you know, it was an immense task that this case is. And you had mentioned earlier that this whole story is so overwhelming. How do you keep it straight? They had done, you know, a full year's worth of investigation. They traveled with me around the various locations for a couple of days, and we recorded on-site interviews. They had also gone and spoken to many of the locals in question, and of course with the district attorney's office, and really put together fantastic series, which is still available on YouTube, asking the question framed by the Golden State Killer. That's the title of the series, and it's in five different parts and is really worthwhile watching for anyone who's interested in the story to be able to understand, you know, where these locations were, who was involved. It's a great summary of the case, and so they deserve tremendous amount of credit for getting some very valuable interviews and providing some new insight beyond even what I could provide.
Now, before we talk about what Joseph DeAngelo was doing in 1972, tell us a little bit about the creation of the 122675 podcast.
Sure. So, you know, as we talked about, we had gone through and met with a lot of these early investigators. We shared with them the reports that we had at that point and asked them for the information. They had then taken and referred the case out to their contemporaries. When it came back as crickets. There is a terrible legacy in this case, and that is that once the Visalia linkage was broken, and that happened in 1978, fully and firmly, once that got derailed, no one wanted to hear the name of that city who was involved in this investigation. Nobody wanted to hear that name place again. And anytime it came up, it was, that's been disproven, that's debunked, that's garbage. I'm not even going to listen to anything. That was wrong for so many reasons that John explained. However, that was the accepted narrative. And when we put together the idea, it's like, you know, how are we going to repair this if law enforcement aren't taking this seriously now and the public have this misperception? How do we go about correcting it? So that was really the genesis of the idea for the podcast, the website, the social media, is to set out the idea to say, let's re-record some of these original transcripts and police reports. Let's tell the story about what happened and what went wrong, and see if there are enough people who are interested in this who can come forward and supplement some of this information and perhaps set it right and explain, you know, what happened with some of the missed connections. And really, there were a couple of things that happened in response to this, and I'll summarize those as being the polar opposite. We had a tremendous number of people who reached out and provided firsthand accounts, agreed to interviews, provided some new evidence for what was going on. And then quite the opposite. The people who wanted to continue the narrative that the connection was improper in the first place, to debunk it, and then to go so far as to publicly expound to in as many ways as they could, whether it was in national media or local media, to continue this narrative that was completely flawed. It was in essence of this battle between two opposing narratives, and was this true or was this not true? So that's really the genesis of the podcast and why it was important to be able to write the book and everything else.
For this incredible event to happen, for this investigation to derail, like you say, in 1978, you introduce all of the important and crucial characters. But first, you go back to 1972 and tell us what Joseph DeAngelo was doing at 26 years of age.
Well, the important part of this whole narrative and what I try to really present in the book is that the book itself is really not about Joe DeAngelo. It's about the people who were investigating him. It's about law enforcement. But I think one of the things that is most troubling here for the public to understand is that Joseph DeAngelo was a fully trained law enforcement officer, far more well-trained than many of his contemporaries. In 1968, he began his career in police studies. He got 2 years Sierra College, got his AA. Then by 1972, he had completed his advanced degree, his BA at Sacramento State. And shortly thereafter, he joined the Roseville Police Department as an intern in their investigation and identification bureau. And so what had happened there was, you know, the one of the critical mysteries is where was the lead up series to the ransacker? Where did he start? Was one of the questions that Larry Poole was very creative in asking about his investigation. One of the things he fed back was, where was Joe DeAngelo when he started? And come to find out that the lead-up series was actually in Rancho Cordova. We now know that he was the Cordova cat burglar. He then moved down to Exeter in the first part of 1973. But really, for that time period where he'd finished at Sac State and in 72 and before he had moved there, he had spent a good almost a year being this home invasion cat burglar in the Rancho Cordova area. And so that really is his genesis. But it's very important, and I want to reemphasize the fact that this case is extremely unusual and remains relevant and important for the simple fact that we still don't fully understand exactly the role of his police training. What did he know, and how did he use that advantage to escape detection? For all of this time, it was clear that he was a police officer. And what does that mean for society? How can we prevent this from happening again if we don't really fully explore the role of his participation in law enforcement? For 6.5 years, he was an active sworn police officer in the state of California. What does that mean?
You talk about, though, that's not so well known at all, is your idea about his motivation.
Yes.
You talk about the average IQ used by jurisdictions, by police departments to hire candidates. And so tell us what your ideas are about this IQ and DeAngelo's resentment.
You know, it is an interesting question, because there is actually there was a civil rights suit brought by someone who failed an IQ test, not because he was because he lacked intelligence, but because he was too intelligent. So he sued the local department asking for a reexamination that allowed him to join the police force, because the theory that the state, but the courts upheld the idea that a law enforcement officer could be too smart to join the ranks, is that, you know, someone who is too smart is going to get bored. And we don't know exactly what happened in the mind of Joe DeAngelo. He has not spoken in any way about that part of his experiences and what happened to why he joined Exeter PD. What we do know is that when he did join, many of his colleagues had asked, I think, a very reasonable question. Why is it someone like you, with all of your training and experience, when you're so smart, you should be with the FBI? Why are you here in this small little city of Exeter? And so it turns out, yes, there is a threshold, and law enforcement entities really do prefer to keep people within a very tight range of the bell curve, and not too smart and certainly not unintelligent, as police officers. So when it gets down to motive, one of the things that is very clear from the pattern of activity is that Joe DeAngelo was always responding to the press and was directly, it appears to me, as if he was directly engaging with some of the particular officers. His, by putting the crimes onto maps and understanding the exact locations and everything, one of the things that became very clear in checking this out, sounding this out with the investigators, it was quite obvious that the offender would strike with great knowledge of jurisdictional boundaries. Jurisdictional boundaries play a big role in policing. Even if you're half a mile outside of city limits and into the county, that affects exactly who is going to be investigating this crime. And we certainly see that in the book, 122675. There are two other very compelling instances where it's documented the offender is striking with great jurisdictional precision. To me, that demonstrates that it was a knowledge of those areas that allowed him to perhaps play what I call a game of cat and mouse, hitting in particular areas, knowing that certain officers would get that case and to be able to play that chase game with them directly.
Is it important to, as you note, that under this cat burglar, the Cordoba yes. Meadows cat burglar, that all of these monikers, early monikers before Vasilia Ransacker, mm-hmm. were the privy of the police themselves. They weren't released to the media. And you talk about him interacting with the media. So how important is it that all of these burglaries, say 200 burglaries, were really not noted by the media whatsoever? Was there something to that, his need?
You know, it is hard to say, again, because we don't have any true insight into the mind of this individual. He has not been willing to speak since to the public and has not spoken to any reporters. So there's a great deal that we're still missing and would be appreciated at some point if we can figure that out. But one of the things that is clear, like for instance with Cordoba, that was a name that was used only internally. And that name does not appear in any of the newspaper stories. It really even received much attention outside the burglary unit for the sheriff's department there. And the same is very much true with the Vasilia Ransacker. The name was barely used at all during the time that the bulk of the burglaries were occurring. It was something that was kind of whispered around town. It's like, you know, what do we call this person? When you have an unknown subject, they often then take on a name. And I've got a few others that are named here in the book, other relevant cases. And those would be examples like the Porterville rapist or even the Tulare cat burglar. And these names get floated around to help law enforcement identify it and solicit information, but to at least have a way to refer to the case easily. The monikers serve those purposes. It's really hard to say with Joe DeAngelo exactly what role he had, if any, in creating these, other than, you know, his jurisdictional precision, striking specifically within a very narrow range in Rancho Cordova, and then returning to that exact same neighborhood as the East Area Rapist. What does that mean? I don't know the answer to that question.
So tell us about DeAngelo's work with Exeter Police, his role there, and how that was connected to his crimes.
Well, we know that he joined Exeter Police Department as a patrolman in 1973. He did not leave Exeter Police Department until mid-August of 1976. So it was just more than 3 years. And something, I think another error that's floating around there in the public narrative is this idea that as soon as the composite sketch came out in Vasilia following the encounter with Detective McGowan, the shooting in the backyard of the Ward residence, that happened in mid-December, of 1975. So well after DeAngelo had already been in that area for 2.5 years. And this narrative that as soon as the sketch came out, as soon as he was identified, DeAngelo fled and went up to Auburn. That's not true. He actually remained in Exeter and as a sergeant and was the lead investigator for the violent crimes unit for Exeter PD after that for another 8 months. So it's an absolute misconception to say that as soon as that sketch was out there and as soon as he was identified, he fled. The other critical part about this is that the first two attacks in the East Area Rapist series occur while Sergeant DeAngelo is still with Exeter PD. The first of those is June 18 of 76, and the next is in July. And we know that he's still active and reporting for duty in Exeter while that's going on. You know, was he aware that he needed to move? Very likely. Was he setting up some kind of confusion again with his ability to strike in a jurisdiction and create the confusion to know how these crimes were going to be investigated? And indeed, that whole question of, you know, where did this offender live throughout the course of the series? You know, we know that the serial rapist series starts in Sacramento and then it expands. And there were many theories floated around from law enforcement about, you know, did he live in Concord? Did he live in Stockton or Modesto or all of these other places? And later on, why was he in Goleta? And how did he end up in Irvine? No one lives in all of these areas. But to be able to create the confusion that exists, to know how crimes are going to be investigated, and to know that people are going to start with the assumption, hey, the person lived in this area at this time, to be able to create the subterfuge of having those first two EAR attacks occur in Sacramento while he's still on Exeter PD, I think is a very fine example of both his tactical awareness as a police officer and his situational awareness as the offender to be able to create that confusion.
Explain for our audience the role of, you talk about Agent McGowan and you talked about Debbie Ward. So tell us more about this stakeout that McGowan was in and why, and his description of the perpetrator.
Yes.
And then how hypnosis, you say, put a big monkey wrench into the investigation itself.
Yes, yes, indeed. All right. Well, I mean, I think that this question really starts out with an exploration of what was going on with the ransacker cases. And it's really important to emphasize again that John wasn't appointed to the case until after the Snelling homicide in September. So they went through and sort of said, you know, let's recalibrate all of our investigation. Let's go through. And he's kind of moved areas within the town. And if we draw these lines, this intersection, over the map of Visalia, we can see how he's kind of shifted. Then they started going back through the reports and pouring back through things. And one of the reports that they found was from a few months prior in July, there was a report of the ransacker having encountered a young girl who returned midday to her home. And as she was walking in through the gate, the subject was fleeing through the apartment that was over the garage. And as he fled down the stairway, he saw the girl, he punched her, knocked her to the ground, and then fled the scene. When they went upstairs and looked, they found, sure enough, this was a ransacker burglary at this residence. Well, this got noted then by the new team of investigators and very carefully said, you know, hey, look, we're mapping everything out here. Let's definitely put this one on here because this is the first time that someone actually saw the offender. So that was an important crime. Well, a few months had gone by and the young girl's mother, when everything was floating around town after the homicide, everybody is on high alert. Well, this young girl's mother had noticed that there were several footprints outside of their bedroom and bathroom windows, and she called the police department, and Agent McGowan responded to the scene. So he's looking around and he's looking at these footprints and noticing this looks curious. There are these weird circular impressions that are in the ground underneath the bathroom window. I wonder what these are. And so he stands there and he looks around the yard and he realizes across the way that there's a flower pot that has been moved, but it was slightly out of place. And so when he picked up the flower pot and he moved it over to the spot where these other circular impressions were, he realized this is the pot where the offender had used to peer into the windows. So it's like he found the clue and realized too that if the offender was coming back, that this would be a valuable piece of information. The second part of what was going on was that in between September and December, as the events were unfolding, it was very frustrating for Visalia PD because every time they were putting out the burglary reports about what was going on and where the patrols were going to be that night, as if by magic, the offender would strike in a completely different area with precision again. And so on the night that they said, hey, look, in case the offender comes back to this residence, let's do a few things differently. Let's have only the team who are assigned to this location be aware of the investigation. We don't want anybody else, even on the force, to be to have knowledge of what's about to unfold. And the second thing is we're going to be radio silent. Absolutely no chatter unless until there's some kind of emergency. And they even went so far as to put like this invisible ink on the sidewalk. So in case the offender stepped on the sidewalk, they would be able to follow his tracks away from and then follow where he went.
Wow.
So they had set up patrol cars around the area to block off as much traffic as they could and realized, you know, let's set the trap. And they did. And on the night in question, the offender started a few blocks away and had another signature ransacking burglary at the home of a medical doctor nearby who had two children. And one of them was one of the cheerleaders that was obviously being stalked. The offender had broken into the home while they were away. Classic Visalia ransacker entry. Stolen a bunch of items and had them on his person when he came to the ward residence next. And in that moment, Agent McGowan had discovered that there appeared to be some activity. He was positioned at the garage across the street with the lights off and then followed the subject over to the yard, had a verbal encounter, and there was an exchange of gunfire during that incident. But before that gunfire erupted, the offender had done something very mysterious. He had lifted up he was wearing a ski mask at the time to conceal his identity. But as McGowan told him, you're under arrest, the offender turned very slowly towards McGowan, lifted the mask up and revealed his face. But that was with one hand. And it appears to me as if simply a distraction, because with his other, he then reaches into his jacket pocket, pulls out his disguised revolver, and turns and fires at Agent McGowan. Because Bill had been with LAPD, one of the things that he was trained to do that was perhaps different and saved his life in that moment was to hold his flashlight away from his body. So rather than being able to shoot where the flashlight was and hit the policeman, he shot at the flashlight, said it was an extended distance by his arm. The shrapnel from that, however, broke apart the flashlight head. The glass piece came up and hit him in the eye and went down to the ground. He called out for help, fired another warning shot, and then the pursuit followed. They tried to capture the suspect, and in fact, the paint worked. They were able to follow a short distance down, backtracked, ended up in some shrubbery along the highway, but disappeared into the night. So for a very brief period of time, for what essentially 10, 15 seconds, Joe DeAngelo was under arrest in the backyard of the ward residence. And that's the only time any law enforcement entity had DeAngelo under arrest as this suspect during any part of the investigation, whether you want to look at any time from 1975 until Cruz homicide in 1986, at no other point in time was DeAngelo under arrest. And so Visalia PD deserve a lot of credit for having such a creative stakeout and for actually capturing the suspect.
What about the description that he gives? What are the specifics?
Well, the description is pretty fantastic. He is able to give, he gives a description after he's in recovery at the hospital. And his description actually matches very closely with that of the report from Beth Snelling, who was the attempted abduction a little ways away earlier in September. Both of them describe an individual who appears to be somewhere between 5'8 and 5'11. Approximately 160 pounds, very athletic. The one thing that was consistent in all the descriptions in terms of the activities of the Visalia ransacker was a strong athletic ability to be able to jump over fences, jump through shrubbery to run and evade any detection. And so all of this lined up. And so It was very clear from the moment that McGowan was describing his suspect that we were talking about the same person. This was the same person who shot at and killed Claude Snelling. This is the same person. And in fact, it's the same caliber of weapon. It was not the same exact weapon, but it was the same caliber of weapon. And, you know, anyone who talks about the importance of police training to the case should realize in both of these instances, we're talking about a snub-nosed 38, and at a short distance, that can be a very deadly and precise instrument. Any distance away, and it becomes a lot harder to be able to control and hit a particular target. One thing that's very clear from D'Angelo's activities as the ransacker is that his targets are a good distance away from him, and he shot at and hit each of his targets with great precision. He shot at and Claude Snelling twice and hit Claude Snelling twice. He shot at Bill McGowan once and hit Bill McGowan's flashlight, dead center. So that told a lot of people that this was someone who was very experienced with handling a 38 revolver, the typical revolver carried by police officers.
Tell us about the hypnosis or the decision to use hypnosis and what that description now becomes in terms of being altered.
Yeah, that's such an important part of this story. So what happens is, you know, after the Snelling incident I mentioned, a few months after this incident had occurred, so before the McGowan shooting, there was a decision to explore hypnosis as a way to perhaps draw out more information about the suspect. And in 1975, this was considered to be very cutting-edge science, was considered to be reliable. In fact, the Los Angeles Police Department had developed a whole unique squad that was training other law enforcement entities around the state of California. They had a federal grant and were going around trying to build up their notoriety. There is even an important article in Time magazine about this squad, and they called themselves the Svengali Squad, or at least they were referred to that publicly. And in going through this, there was the opportunity to take Beth Snelling down to Los Angeles and to be hypnotized by the lead investigators there and to draw out hopefully some information. And the way that Vaughn describes that trip is that with Beth and her mom and two officers taking the family down to Los Angeles, there was a lot of apprehension that the young girl had regarding what had happened and was any part of this her fault, you know, and the fact that her father rescued her and gave his life to rescue her certainly, you know, wore heavily on her brain and her conscience. That's very understandable. But when she got down there, she went through the hypnosis session and they drew out a few things. There was only really one very minor detail that came out through the hypnosis that was in any way different from the three other descriptions. She had met with Visalia PD three times before this and had given a very clear set of information, was always clear and consistent. And then after that, going back through things, there was only one really thing that was substantially different, and that was the addition of this unusual note of the offender having short, stubby fingers. And other than that, it was very much a retelling. The only thing that was added to that was, you know, on the way back home from, you know, Visalia is about halfway between Los Angeles and Sacramento, so it's a good ways away. And on the way, on return trip home, Vaughn noted that Beth really had a sense of peace that she didn't have before, an understanding and a calmness about her that wasn't there before the hypnosis. However, after the McGowan shooting, we've got a whole other kettle of fish. And this really illustrates exactly why hypnosis is so flawed. For some people, it's very beneficial and therapeutic. And for other people, it's perhaps the worst thing possible you could do. What had happened with the McGowan hypnosis was, again, Bill, I think, you know, as a law enforcement officer, certainly felt some apprehension himself. He, after all, had this suspect under his gun. He told him he was under arrest. And I'm certain that he felt he had his own emotions as a law enforcement officer for letting this murderer get away. So he certainly wanted to do everything he could to be helpful to the story. One of the things we know, however, is that after the before his hypnosis, they had put out a suspect description in the local newspaper. They published a composite sketch. They'd gone through and really worked out quite a lot of information before he went to the hypnosis. And we're starting to get some clues come in from members of the public. And there was a case that got investigated before the hypnosis. And it appears to me as if the court's warning about hypnosis was exactly correct, that what you're thinking about during the time of the hypnosis, subsequent to the events, gets mixed into your understanding, your awareness, and sometimes the ability then to incorporate thoughts, fears, concerns, suspicions, anything like that. It's incorporated and becomes fact. And that appears to be what happened with the McGowan hypnosis, is that he incorporated a completely different person, peeping suspect, who was spotted a couple years prior and was reported, an encounter was reported. And all of those details got conflated into his new description. If you go back and look pre-hypnosis and compare that to the garbage, the literal garbage that comes out during hypnosis, it's just disturbing. And Vaughn was present in the room while McGowan was undergoing the hypnosis. And he said that he was completely agitated. He was sick to his stomach. He kept calling out where Shipley, the other officer who was with him at the scene of the Ward residence, the scene of the shooting that night, where Shipley, and all of this intensely emotional. They even had to stop the session once and resume it for him to be able to continue. It was the complete opposite of what had happened with Beth Snelling. And unfortunately, too, every time that McGowan was later on called to think about his description, he got to the point where it got so confused for him in his own mind, he would look at the suspect description and read the suspect description he had read and drawn out before the hypnosis and said, that's not the guy. He got so in his head about what happened that got mixed up, which is exactly why a few years later in 1982, there's a very important decision in a state called Shirley. And that case told California law enforcement, that's it. No more hypnosis in the courts. It's completely unreliable. And on top of that, there is actual demonstrable proof that people are giving incorrect descriptions. They're incorporating what law enforcement wants them to say. And if law enforcement is in any way involved in these hypnosis sessions, this is inadmissible evidence. The witness is completely tainted, and you can't just pick out part of this. That witness is no longer able to testify reliably about the incident.
Let's use this as an opportunity, Tony, to talk about our sponsor, which is Ritual. Gaps in the diet shouldn't be ignored. Over 97% of women aged 19 to 50 are not getting enough vitamin D from their diet, and 95% are not getting their recommended daily intake of key omega-3s. Ritual's Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin was formulated by exhaustive research to help fill nutrient gaps in the diets of women age 18 plus. It is formulated with nutrients to help support brain health, bone health, blood health, and provide antioxidant support. Ritual invested in a gold standard university-led clinical trial to prove the impact of Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin. Essential for Women 18 Plus was shown to increase vitamin D levels by 43% and omega-3 DHA levels by 41% in 12 weeks. Now Ritual has just released Symbiotic, a gut health supplement with clinically studied prebiotics, probiotics, and a postbiotic all in one minty capsule. My wife Lisa and I were initially impressed with Ritual's successful clinical trials, and Lisa decided to try Ritual's Essential for Women 18 plus, and she was again impressed. And when Ritual for Men 50 plus became available, I began to take Ritual every day. It's been over 2 years for me and almost 4 years for Lisa, and we both continue to feel a significant difference every day taking Ritual. Right now, Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/murder and turn healthy habits into a ritual. That's 10% off at ritual.com/murder. Now, Tony, we were talking about hypnosis and its debunking officially by the Supreme Court to say that it would not be allowed. Let's get to Sergeant Vaughn. You say he was there when McGowan was first describing the perpetrator. Tell us about the efforts by Sergeant Vaughn, and including your conversations with him as well, that about what he was trying to put forth about the connection between Vesalia Ransacker and East Area Rapist, and who he was stating these claims to.
Sure. Well, the next chapter where the story goes is, this is essentially now the hypnosis session is in January of 1976. And they also meet with a leading psychologist. At the time, his name was Jewel Fort. And they're at that point trying to put together the information that they have from the various reports, from the information from McGowan, the composite sketch, and what they know about the offender. And they do a pass at an early psychological profile. And key in this profile is the determination that the offender very likely did not live in the area where the crimes were being committed, that he appeared to have a pattern that would be consistent with someone who lived approximately 10 to 15 miles away, would drive to the areas where the crimes were occurring, and then return home and try to relive the events. Whatever else we might say about some of the other remarkable things that are in the report, that's astonishingly correct. There's a lot in there that we look at now and go, well, that might not be such a good thing to say. But other than that, that was one thing in the reports that was really fantastic. And so essentially through the efforts of combining the information, one of the other critical things that the Vesalia Police Department had done was to use an early computerized system that was being developed by the California Department of Justice. And this was the CII system. So they had the ability in the CII system to track things like stolen property, and even were developing what was called an MO, a method of operation or modus operandi database, that would allow the Department of Justice to receive tips to say, if we've got an offender who's following these particular traits, and they put in some of the things that the psychologist had developed, and they put in together some of the things that were in the reports, and created this profile that was uploaded to the California system. Well, after the East Area Rapist series was started in Sacramento in June of 76, and then continued and accelerated through the first year or so, it turns out that they too, Sacramento, were inputting information into the same system, which is exactly what it's designed to do. And a hit emerged, and that clue was then followed. As soon as both entities got the alert, hey, there's a match of your information, you both should check this out. So that was the first trip that Vesalia Police Department had made to Sacramento. So they carried up with them their reports about the ransacker, his unusual burglaries, this report of the Snelling homicide, the very strong similarities in the Snelling homicide to the East Area Rapist series. The fact that the offender appears suddenly in the bedroom of the sleeping victim, puts hands over her mouth, is completely disguises his voice and his face, uses a weapon, is transporting the victim out of the residence, and a number of other strong similarities. So they're looking, Vesalia PD are looking at this, they're looking at the burglaries, and they're going up to Sacramento and saying, so we're showing you our cards, you show us yours. And they have an initial conversation, and they're looking at this, and they're saying, this is pretty strong. This is looking pretty good as far as a match. At that point in time, too, by the time they're actually up there, they're now looking at a total of 13. The first 13 in the series are on this list. I have the list that was written out, which cases those were, and they were looking essentially at that point in time. Well, when another year goes by and there's still not been any activity, they go up and they make a second trip to Sacramento. And this time, you know, they're going through the cases and they're looking a little closer. They make the decision to say, you know, hey, maybe we should do a public appeal. Maybe we should seek information because we did this in Vesalia. We got some great leads. So they went to the Sacramento Union and gave them an interview. And one of the things that Vaughn put in that interview that is just truly remarkable, and perhaps one of the greatest clues that he had noticed, one of the most unique MO points, was that the offender who was known to him as the ransacker, but up in Sacramento was the East Area Rapist, both of these offenders, the VR and the EAR, both had the habit of taking stolen items from one scene and leaving them at another scene, either by trying to implicate someone from the victim's residence and planting evidence at another location, or taking items from one burglary and planting them at the victim's residence. It was nonsensical in a way, right, but it was the same thing that kept happening over and over again. And it was clear to Devon, and his words were, both men have the peculiarity of taking things from one scene and leaving them at another. And those words were something that became really important for the Richmond homicide, where Oscar Clifton was a suspect, because that's exactly the only critical piece of physical evidence in the case. An invoice book that was discovered at the scene belonged to Oscar Clifton. There's no doubt about it. He did not ever deny that the book was his. But that was the impetus for making this connection between Vasilia and Sacramento in the first place. And as further proof of this, that's exactly what happened later on when the East Area Rapist would move down to the Goleta area near Santa Barbara. Another MO hit came up on the same CII system. California Department of Justice told Sacramento, hey, your offender matches these other weird burglaries and this homicide down in Goleta. You guys should take a look.
Right.
So here's Sacramento's Sheriff's Department completely sandwiched between the pre-years, where Vasilia follows them up using the CII system, and as he exits, following the same CII system away from Sacramento. It's quite disturbing when you look at it in retrospect that the information was there the whole time and that it was not properly followed. But again, because the Vasilia connection got so derailed, and you know, going back to this story of the Sacramento Union, the thing that seemed to upset Sacramento Sheriff's Department the most was the implication that the East Area Rapist had been the Vasilia ransacker, not because of the burglaries, but because of the Snelling homicide.
Right.
The quote that's in the newspaper from the spokesman, Bill Miller, calls out the fact that it was unprofessional and irresponsible for Vasilia PD to suggest that the East Area Rapist was a person who was capable of homicide. Oh. And obviously now when we're sitting here in 2022 and we know that it was the same person, that's even more reprehensible. But looking at it even then, the thought, I believe, was that they just didn't want to scare the community. They didn't want them to be on high alert. They didn't want them to be facing the fact that not only was this person who had committed essentially 50 rapes in the Sacramento area just going around causing complete terror and panic and seemed to escape every possible trap that they were trying to set for him, that this person was also a killer. I think now that we know the exact timeline, there's one more piece that's devastating to that narrative, because what we're talking about there is June of 1978 on the second visit when Vasilia are there. And what we know now is that Joe DeAngelo had, in fact, killed in Sacramento, that he admitted responsibility for the double homicide of Brian and Katie Majori. And that happened in February right. of 1978. So a few months before this, a case that was not connected to the East Area Rapist until much later, 1999 or 2000, I believe, is the first instance where Sacramento said, hey, we're now looking at the East Area Rapist for being responsible for this pair of murders.
Sure.
Why is it that such a terrible conflation of these homicides and this motive of not scaring the public? How did this happen? How did this unfold? And knowing the timeline, we know now that he did get away with those homicides for many years. And what does that say about not following the evidence? It's pretty painful. And I understand why now in retrospect, Sacramento doesn't really want to talk about that exact timeline and how things line up with the warning that came from Sergeant Vaughn and Vasilia PD.
Tell our audience about Jennifer Armour.
Yeah, this is the case that actually inspired my reach to Sergeant Vaughn to see if he was aware of this case. Before really picking any investigation with him, one of the things I had done was to map out the Vasilia ransacker series as I knew it to be. And after he got assigned the case, he said, you know, I'm going to start with my investigation and we're going to draw a line in these prior ransackings, because he's really moved his area of activity. In 1974, he was very active, but it was in a different part of town. if, and I drew these four quadrants for John, and I said, what do these quadrants mean in terms of, you know, your patrol zones? And he said, that's an exact match for where we did our patrols. These are the boundaries for our patrol zones. And so you could look and say he was active in zone one in this first part of 1974, and then shifted. And so Vaughn said, you know, let's investigate these other crimes more carefully. Well, the implication for that, unfortunately for Jennifer Armour's case, is that her abduction occurred in November of 1974, just a month shy of where this line had been drawn by Visalia PD. And it's unclear now, you know, what would have happened if Vaughn had noticed that and said, hey, we've got this other case. So I noticed this case as being an unsolved homicide from another investigation that I was doing, and picked this up and said, you know, hey, how does this line up? Because this young girl lived in this zone where he was most active in 1974. And then when she is actually abducted, we can see that she's only two blocks away from where the Snelling homicide occurred. Is there any correlation here? And second part of the question, was this case ever investigated by you? Do you know anything about this? And I basically got a blank look, one of the only times that I got a blank look from John, and we missed it. He was very honest and upfront, and he said, you know, had I known about this, I definitely would have explored this, but no, I was simply unaware. And I think the principal cause of that was the way that the case was investigated. This young girl was on her way to the crosstown football game, homecoming night. It's a big deal in Visalia. It's called the Cowhide Game, and Mount Whitney versus Redwood. And she was walking from her home down in the zone one and ends up in zone two near the Snelling house, where she's last seen a few blocks away from where she's supposed to meet a friend and get a ride to the game. She never shows up. And this 15-year-old girl didn't have a car, didn't have a driver's license, didn't have any way to transport herself. So she goes missing that night. Her mom reports her missing the next day, and police presume that she's a runaway. However, nothing appears for the better part of 10 days. On that day, a rancher out just north of Exeter discovers her body in the Frank Kern Canal. She's pulled out, and it's discovered that her hands are bound behind her back using her own bra. She's partially disrobed. Some of the items of clothing are found nearby. The quote in the newspaper, and I kid you not, is, we don't know how she got there. We'd sure like to know. And that's as much as seemed to be put out publicly about the case. And as a matter of fact, they go so far as to say it could be foul play, but we're, you know, it could be a runaway. We simply don't have enough information here to tell us what happened. So in essence, for the first year after her death, law enforcement treated the case as a runaway, and that she met some unfortunate mishap, and we don't know what happened. And certainly had the case been in front of Vaughn to say, hey, wait a minute, we've got another student, an actual classmate of Beth Snelling, who is abducted, transported to Exeter, where she had no reason, no connection to be. And she's taken from the exact area where the Snelling homicide occurs. What's going on here? So that was the first clue that took the investigation back to Exeter. But another one that was equally important was that shortly after the Snelling homicide, there were two items that were found in between another city, Farmersville, and Exeter, well out closer towards Exeter, on a connecting road called Avenue 256, one of the only roads that connects all the way through from Visalia to Exeter. And they found there a gun that had a serial number that matched one of the VR burglaries, and they found some loot. They found wrapped inside a clear plastic raincoat a screwdriver that matched the pry marks of the Visalia ransack, plus some additional loot, some ammo that was noted that matched the description of some of those items. And they found those on both sides of this very narrow road, local offshoot called Hypericum Road. That becomes important later on in the story. And in essence, that was the second clue that said to, so we said to John, so other than this young girl who was taken from Visalia and found out in Exeter, and this loot found in Exeter, you know, what are some of the other things? And it was noted too that the psychologist report, one of the places that he mentioned as a possibility was the city of Exeter. And so, you know, putting these things together, it led to the strong possibility that Jennifer Armour was A, abducted by the Vasilian ransacker, that B, there was an Exeter connection. And with the loot, what happened with that investigation? So being able to talk to John and ask him the questions about how that was explored, what suspects they looked at, and where that ended, I think became really critical to answer the question about Jennifer Armour. Other note that I want to make is that after we were proceeding and talking about the case and well before D'Angelo's identification, we asked for a meeting with the sheriff's office. And because the case was, and even though it was an abduction in Visalia and the body was found near Exeter, neither one of those municipalities was actually involved in the investigation. Because the body was placed in the canal north of Exeter, where the body is found is in California, where the homicide jurisdiction is based. So in this instance, the homicide of Jennifer Armour was being handled by the Tulare County Sheriff's Office and by no other entities. It is quote unquote their case. So when we sat down, we said, hey, look, this was in September of 2017. We said, you know, hey, look, here's all of this evidence that connected the Visalia ransacker, that connected the Exeter loot, that connected these Exeter locations. Because the meeting also incorporated, hey, this is why these clues exist to connect the Visalia ransacker to the Richmond investigation and the wrongful conviction of Oscar Clifton. They certainly didn't want to hear that. As a matter of fact, their exact words, we have no interest in litigating that case. So in that moment, they had 0.00 interest in hearing about the Armour case and about that investigation.
Let's use this as an opportunity, Tony, to stop for these messages. Now, you're talking about that you just mentioned Donna Richmond and the wrongful conviction of Oscar Clifton. Let's get to Donna Richmond's murder.
Yeah. Well, December 26, 1975, the day after Christmas, you know, Exeter is a really small town. It's really about a mile and a half square end to end, 10,000 people. It's the citrus capital of the world. That's their own local moniker. Orange groves everywhere. And in fact, this case is primarily about two different orange groves. One outside the city limits on the south end and one outside the city limits on the north end. Where Donna Richmond is, you know, her day that day is completely around the city limits of Exeter. She starts off at her home. She's riding around visiting friends, taking care of some animals for some people that are out of town, visits her friends on the west side of town, goes up and last seen at her boyfriend's house in the northwest corner of town. So she's supposed to be home. According to her father, she's supposed to be home by 4 o'clock. He gets home at 5 o'clock and he says, fortunately, the worst words that any parent could say, where's Donna? She's not home. And they begin a search and can't find her, report her missing to the police department, to the Exeter Police Department, by the way. And they don't find anything for several hours. Shortly there, around this time, her brother, with a friend, goes out on a siding road nearby, a grove road that runs behind the home, a shortcut that they used, and they find her brother and the friend find a bicycle, and it's hers, and it's sitting there in the grove, in the dark grove at this point. Fog is setting in, and there at the scene, there are some bottles and cans. There are these two notebooks that are on the ground, and no sign of Donna. And they go back, they get the dad, they start driving around asking more questions. Exeter PD responds to the scene and they call the sheriff's office, and the sheriff's office realize, hey, we're outside the city limits, we're taking lead. And that's all really going full force now by 8 p.m. So the investigation, I can encapsulate the investigation of this homicide, is occurring between 8 p.m. and 12 p.m. that night in that location, well before Donna's body is ever found. All of the evidence that they, quote unquote, ever needed to convict this man was found at this place at this time. And that comes down to one thing, that is Oscar Clifton's invoice book, which I mentioned previously. It is the only piece of physical evidence that, connected him to the crime. And he didn't deny that it was his. His only statement was, I have no idea how it got there. How did my invoice book end up at this location? Well, the other thing that is present there at this location is a small notepad, a jotter notepad, the very style that police officers are known to carry. And that notepad is filled with numerical equations, some addition, some subtraction, and some other things. No handwriting is on it. But curiously, the sheriff's department notes that on the outside of both the small jotter notepad and the invoice book, there are no fingerprints. Both appear to have been, quote unquote, smudged or wiped clean of fingerprints.
Right.
So we don't know what happened or why. We don't know who did that, but there are no fingerprints on the inside. And at the time, there was no investigation made into this small jotter notepad. The only thing that we have is that it was photographed, and that a photograph of the drawings, the numbers that appear inside are captured in that form. Other than that, we don't know anything else about it. And during the course of the trial, when this becomes an important item of evidence, an important question, it simply became, we determined that it was not part of the case.
Right.
There was never any explanation for the identity of that notepad. The whole focus was on Oscar Clifton's invoice book. Well, the problem immediately ensues if in a case like this with an alibi. You know, if you're not at this location committing this homicide, where are you?
Right.
And fortunately for Oscar Clifton, the sheriff's office just did not investigate his alibi until the trial was actually starting. So about 6 months later, they go in and ask some important questions only after the, you know, all of this other time had elapsed and people's memories were shortened, et cetera. But there is one critical witness who was not revealed to the defense, who very clearly places Oscar Clifton at the work site in Visalia, 11 miles away from the crime at the time it occurred, according to the prosecution timeline. And there is no way to reconcile those two events. This witness, a young boy of about 11 years old, his testimony was just never provided and never disclosed. And that accounts for the many years of mystery about this. As a matter of fact, that the tape of that interview is found in the desk drawer of the lead investigating officer who I mentioned in the name by name book. His name is Bob Byrd. Detective Sergeant Bob Byrd worked with the Sheriff's Department for many years. He illegally ordered the destruction of the case evidence after the trial was over. There is no reason to believe now, I feel, that in light of his illegal actions later on, that he was not also involved in hiding this alibi tape that very clearly identified Oscar Clifton being at the alibi location at the time of the crime.
You state a reason for Oscar Clifton to believe that this is just police harassment. Tell us about this charge that he did have and where he might have got that idea.
Well, there is another case that stems from 1965, wherein Oscar Clifton was arrested and was served a six-month term in county jail for an attempted rape. The implication of that is, of course, to paint Oscar Clifton with a dark and suspicious brush. The important part of this as evidence, though, is really important to dig into because there are two really critical forces and factors involved in this. Number one, the investigating officer who arrested Oscar Clifton in 1965, so 10 years prior for this, is the same officer who's involved in the destruction of the evidence and hiding this tape. It's Bob Byrd. You know, it's really hard because you feel like, you know, why would anyone, you know, go so far out of his way to pin so many things on an individual? What would cause such hate? And what we know now is that there was a great deal of personal animosity between the individuals. And as a matter of fact, one of the reasons that I think Lilia Luciano and Mike Bunnell for their work on the case, is actually captured in an interview with Bob Byrd, wherein he describes his role in the cases and his knowledge of Clifton. And in particular, he says two things. One, he says, yes, there was animosity between us. Mm-hmm. And number two, he says, I didn't have anything to do with arresting Oscar Clifton in 1965. And secondly, I didn't have anything to do with arresting him in 1975. And third is, I didn't have anything to do with destroying the evidence. His three statements about that are absolutely 100% factually false. The police report from 1965, he's signed at the bottom as the arresting officer. We know he was the arresting officer. Number two, regarding the evidence destruction, his name is specifically on the evidence destruction by the two other officers who admit in writing then to completing this illegal act that they did so at the direct order of Bob Byrd. And third, that, you know, for Byrd in his statement to Lilia, he admits that had he done that, that would have been an illegal act. It's one of the only things that he says in the interview, unfortunately, that is very true, is that, yes, going back clearly to 1965, it was very well-founded California law. If you're in custody, if you're either arrested for a crime or you've been tried and convicted, so long as you're in the jurisdiction of the state, the race of the state, that the state is compelled to hold and maintain the evidence used for your trial and conviction for the period where you are in custody and for 1 year thereafter. So here we've got an instance where Bob Byrd ordered the destruction of this evidence within 6 months of the time that the conviction was garnered.
Right.
That is incomprehensible by any standard. As a matter of fact, every law enforcement officer I've talked about this case is like, are you sure? Are you certain about that? That is deeply disturbing and illegal. That is almost like it can't happen. And yet it did. And yet that's the very reason why so much of the truth that we now want to know about this case. What was the evidence? Were there any things, items that could have been tested that could still have exonerated Oscar Clifton through DNA? And so had that material been preserved, would have been available when DNA testing was finally ordered in the case in 2010. And it was not until that time, it was not until 2010 when the state, when Tulare County finally admitted to the court that yes, these items were destroyed in our custody and they were ordered at the destruction of this lead investigator on this case. It's in writing. It's a court admission. The sad part about that is that there was never any criminal investigation into the significance of that. It had been clear that had there been a hearing on this, it could have come out that yes, in fact, since the evidence is no longer available to be tested that would have been used to exonerate him, that's a due process violation and Oscar Clifton could have been exonerated in that moment. Instead, he would die in prison 3 years after that round of DNA testing happened.
Let's use it as an opportunity to stop for these messages. Now, you talked about that he died in prison. Well, we haven't talked about why on earth would they frame Oscar Clifton and cover up the crimes of D'Angelo. What would be the motive for Byrd, for all of them?
Yeah, this is a really tough one. And I try to delve into that in some cases in the book. Obviously, there's only one person who can answer this question, who is still alive and has admitted that if the actions were true, he would have committed a crime. Let me point out something that I think is really significant here is that in the state of California, there is a penal code statute that says if false evidence is used to obtain a death penalty conviction, which Oscar Clifton was ultimately charged with and found by the jury as part of the verdict, Oscar Clifton was given death sentence initially. That was later commuted for the simple fact that as the evidence would show, there was not a rape. The charge that was presented at trial was attempted rape, not rape. There was never any evidence of that. The autopsy confirmed it. The testimony of the coroner confirmed all of this. There was no actual rape. So it comes down to the question of what evidence was there at the time? And if we're presenting false evidence, what is the implication of that? This crime provides for the death penalty for the person who procures false evidence to obtain a false conviction. And that's really important because the death penalty, any death penalty case, has no statute of limitations. So I would say, even though there has never once been any prosecution of this particular statute, this would be a great time for the state of California to be looking at this and saying, wait a minute, did we put an innocent man on death row? Did we subject him to a death penalty through false evidence? And if so, that case is still has no statute of limitations. This could be investigated today. So that's why, number one, this is everything else that I'm about to say is still viable information. Number two, because of the way that the crime was really investigated that night, December 26, 1975, it was focused on this invoice book and around the bicycle and really well before the body is found. And this idea that they needed to arrest Oscar Clifton as soon as they could. And that's exactly what they did. By 1 a.m., they had him in custody on suspicion of homicide and kidnapping charges and anything that they could. And to search his home illegally without a warrant. They arrested him without a warrant. And again, it's Bob Byrd's name at the bottom of those documents. So his denial that he was there is once again highly suspicious.
Right.
Then we go back to the question of Byrd and D'Angelo. And the other thing that's really important is the way that the sheriff's office and the city police department in Exeter worked. The sheriff's office at that time didn't have a lot of extra money to have a lot of substations. So they would essentially ask each of the municipalities to carve out a corner where they could put a desk and a radio and have the sheriffs be able to use this little corner as their quote unquote substation. And that's exactly what happened in Exeter. The night of December 26, while this investigation is proceeding, they are using the Exeter Police Department to conduct this investigation. That's in Byrd's notes about where they're meeting and where all of this is being coordinated. Joe D'Angelo is working as he is the head of the violent crimes unit in Exeter, starting in October of 75. So 2 months prior to this, he is the lead investigator for violent crimes. So we have that nexus. Then we have another problem. We have the loot that I mentioned earlier.
Right.
The loot is found on Avenue 256 out near Exeter, and it's found on a road named Hypericum Road. If you look at the 1975 phone directory, as I have many times, the only address listing for Oscar Clifton, because he'd been away from the area for a number of years after his initial arrest, he'd moved back, but he hadn't had his phone for very long, and so he wasn't in the directory. In fact, the only listing there is his parents, who live on Hypericum Avenue. Deeply suspicious, number two. Number three is that at the Richmond homicide location where she's found the day after the bicycle is found, she's found early that afternoon. At that location, there's also a ski mask, which matches the description exactly that provided by Beth Snelling. It's a zigzag pattern. It's very unusual design. And, was the offender, was D'Angelo trying to say, I'm painting this picture, I'm telling you that the person who killed Donna Jo Richmond was the same person who killed Claude Snelling, and he wore this mask, and you should follow this lead. And an interesting coincidence, and something that we'll never know, because among the items destroyed was the ski mask. So again, had that been available for testing, that certainly would have been powerful physical evidence. Then on top of that, we have another critical issue for Bob Byrd. One of the other things that he denies in his interview with Lily Luciano is that he ever knew the name Joe D'Angelo. He said, I have no familiarity with that name, never heard it before. That's pretty incredible for someone who works at the Exeter substation and is in the city. Bob Byrd not just lived in Exeter for this time frame, but worked there as well.
Right.
More, perhaps even most compelling about that is that where Bob Byrd's home is two doors. And I want to say that again, just for the people in the back of the room, two doors away from where Joe D'Angelo lived for this entire period. Joe D'Angelo, his name and address are on his marriage license issued in November of 73. It's on Emperor Street. 600 block of Emperor Street. At the intersection there, his duplex walked two doors up and you were at the home of Tulare County Detective Sergeant Bob Byrd. It would be absolutely the greatest coincidence in the world for him to live two doors away. And the way that the streets are aligned for him, the only way for him to access his home from the west side would be to drive around the corner, King, and then Emperor, and then on to Peach. The only way for him to access his home would be to drive by the spot where everybody else in town described seeing Joe DeAngelo's police car parked outside his Emperor residence. I have no explanation for Byrd's words, Byrd's involvement. Finally, I want to say one more thing about Byrd and what he knew that was unique. In the course of the proceedings, Oscar Clifton is brought to trial in late June of 1976. And there's another offender who's been operating in the area at the time, who went under the moniker the Porterville Rapist. He was arrested, charged, and confessed to ultimately, I believe it was seven, although he was charged with 13, charged with these seven particular rapes. And he confessed to them and was found guilty for those charges. During the trial, he's arrested while the trial's going on. He's being surveilled and then arrested immediately. I think it's maybe 2 days after the verdict's rendered. And it turns out that during the time, right after his arrest is procured, that Sacramento sheriffs, the same investigator for the East Area Rapist, contact the Tulare County Sheriff's Department and tell them to put a hold on their suspect, Ben Galloway, because his description and the activities that he did inside the home appear to be such a close match to the East Area Rapist. Yeah. So what they do is they deliver the information about the series and they put a hold on him. And it's not until there is another rape immediately while Galloway's after in custody, after he's in custody, that they say, wait a minute, we got the wrong guy, obviously. The series is continuing. You can take off our hold. But in that intervening period, they had delivered to Byrd, the head of the violent crimes unit, they had delivered to him, perhaps one of the first people to see the first two EAR MO points that anyone in law enforcement had seen at that point. So he had had some familiarity already with the East Area Rapist MO. The second thing is that by February of 1977, they had developed enough of a profile about the East Area Rapist to deliver an interagency memorandum. And in this memo, they describe not just his MO, but his physical description and one other key attribute, and that is the blood type of the offender.
Yes.
The blood type is type A, and that is DeAngelo's blood type. And you say, well, wait a minute, isn't he a non-secretor? It turns out that the reason they were able to get it, yes, they did confirm through the blood test, so through the serology that they were doing at the time, that yes, the offender wasn't a non-secretor, but the blood type came from a scuffle during one of the rape victims. She had used his own knife and caused him to cut himself, and he bled on the victim. And she being a different blood type, they were able to distinguish this, and they said, aha, this is the offender's blood that came from the knife wound. We now know that he's a type A. They had a lot of information about the offender. And so that when they put out this interagency memo in February of 1977 is suspicious. And the reason I use the word suspicious, because February 28, 1977 is the date that Byrd had ordered the destruction of the evidence in the Clifton case. I mean, without any explanation, without any benefit of the law or any other reason, there had been only one blood type that was identified in the analysis of the evidence during the Richmond case. And this goes exactly contrary to the statement that the Tulare County DA's office issued in their quote-unquote conviction integrity review. They stated improperly in that review that the offender, whoever, all of the material that they examined in that, that there was, the criminalist had never identified a blood type of any of the samples. That is not true. At grand jury, one of the criminalists testified that the sample that he tested of the crusted collection of mud and debris from the skin of the victim, he developed a blood type A. That was not his testimony at trial. It appeared to be exculpatory information, mm-hmm. which was hidden from defense counsel. There's no explanation yes. for why defense counsel didn't himself read the grand jury transcript. There's a lot of other reasons to call into question Ray Donahue's mm-hmm. integrity and actions as defense counsel in this case. That aside, it is an absolute misstatement for anyone to say that no criminalist identified a blood type. In fact, there was, and it was type A. Type A is D'Angelo's blood type, and it was the EAR's blood type confirmed in this memo that was distributed at the exact time. So here is Bob Byrd now looking at all of these different things. He now sees that the person that, if he had any reason to suspect that D'Angelo's timing for his departure for the East Area Rapist series, a person that Sacramento had contacted him to say, hey, wait a minute, do you have any information about maybe someone who left Tulare and came up here? Do you have any other crimes in the area that you were working? Do you have any other forces or factors that could make anyone from your area be an East Area Rapist suspect? He has all of that information, and apparently he says nothing. He knows, too, that the blood type that they did develop in the Richmond case is now an exact match on this memorandum. I don't have any explanation. All I have are questions, and none of them appear to be in any way comfortable questions for Bob Byrd. I would very much like the state of California to get him under subpoena, get his testimony before he dies, and answer that very question. What did you know? When did you know it? And why did you destroy this evidence? Because it appears as if now you were covering either for your colleague, for your neighbor, or for the person that you knew had fled to Sacramento at the exact time this series picks up in Sacramento.
I want to thank you so much, Tony Reed, for coming on and talking about your extraordinary book, 12, 26, 75. We could go on for a lot longer trying to explain this incredible story. For those people that might want to take another look or more, take a longer look, is there a website for this book? Tell us more.
Yes. So the website has the same name, same title as the book. It's 12-26-75, 12-26-75.com. That's the URL. There's also a Facebook group, December 26, 75, that has all of this. And, you know, where the book has a lot more information in it. It's not just a restatement of the podcast. There's a lot more new information that I've learned since doing even the last episode about 8 months ago. I cover a lot of things in the podcast that are not in this book. So there's definitely some benefit to listening to those. There are total 42 episodes. If you really like hearing my voice so far, you're going to really like hearing a lot more in these other episodes. And I go into the DNA testing that supposedly excluded D'Angelo and why the Tulare DA's office are absolutely mistaken in their interpretation of that evidence. There's a whole 2 episodes about the flaws in that analysis and how I've had that examined by external forensic scientists who confirm my findings.
Yes, well, that's incredible. Thank you so much, Tony Reed, 12-26-75. It's been fascinating. Thank you so much, Tony. Have a good night.
Thank you, Dan. Take care.
Thank you.
Good night, all.
Good night.